I first met Frank Zappa in 1973 in Hernando's Hideaway in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in L.A. He and Gail were roosting there while their house was being redecorated. I was sighing heavily as I rattled my airmail copy of the Times, so they asked me over to their table, and I told them that my then-boyfriend had just accused me of giving him pubic lice. In no time, Frank had me bundled out of the hotel into his black Bentley and off to Schwab's drugstore, where he demanded in a loud voice the famous blue ointment. I saw a good deal of Frank and Gail in the 70s, and I came to respect Frank as one of the sanest, truest, and hardest-working people I have ever met. He was a good father, a good husband, a vicious satirist, and a great musician. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the beginning of his recording career. He released his first album, Freak Out, in 1966.
Mr. America, walk on by your schools that do not teach. What will you do if we let you go?
In The Real Frank Zappa book, he quoted Flaubert, "Be regular and ordered in your life so that you may be violent and original in your work." And that was exactly how Frank went about things.
His father worked for the army developing chemical weapons.
Peter Occhio Grosso, who assisted Frank in writing that book.
And he was constantly moving. So Frank was always the new kid in school. And I think that very much shaped his attitude and his sort of rebelliousness. Zappa represents the child in everyone that was rejected by its parents, who was distrusted by adults, teachers, authority figures. And I think that because he was always near where his father worked with chemical weapons, they had gas masks and chemical biohazard suits and that kind of thing around the house when he was growing up. And I think that gives you a little slightly skewed persona.
A persona that skewed itself into a life in music.
Well, I got into it for reasons that are quite different than what most people have for going into the music business. Most people say, I'm going to be a star and I'm going to have all these girls chasing me all over the place. And because there is a mirror in my house, I knew that that was not going to be the case for me. And after shaving my face for all those years, I was convinced that I'd better have another reason for going into the music business. And so I found one. It was because I loved music.
Frank was completely uncompromising in all aspects of his life. He was a perfectionist in his music and just as conscientious as a family man. Son Dweezil.
He was hilarious. We all just had, growing up, just so much respect for him. So we really didn't get into a lot of trouble. We didn't do all the kind of crazy things that you hear about a lot of show business families with kids in rehab a million times and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've never taken a drug in my life. I've never smoked a cigarette. I've never been drunk. I've never done any of that stuff. Never had any interest in it. And it's mainly because when I went to Frank's concerts when I was little and I saw people acting weird and sort of out of control, he said, hey, you see those people? Because I, you know, he could see that I was a little bit scared, perhaps, by some of these people. He said, all those people that are acting weird are on drugs, and they use drugs as an excuse to be an asshole. And because I had so much respect for him, I knew that, well, it clicked early on for me.
But despite his hatred of drugs, there was nothing solemn about Frank Zappa, and certainly nothing prudish. His lyrical subjects ranged from lavatorial schoolboy humor to vitriolic assaults on American society. His rock side was influenced by doo-wop, the blues, and Johnny Guitar Watson. His orchestral compositions were inspired by Varese, Stravinsky, and Webern. They were beautiful and complex, though they could also include musical jokes befitting a latter-day Spike Jones. His sense of humor was at his artistic core. The secret of Frank's genius came from his formal education, or lack of it. His freedom of thought and his freedom of musical expression resulted from the fact that nobody taught him the rules. He still had to know how to write music, though, so he worked it out for himself. This is Gail Zappa, whom he married in 1967.
Yeah, he's self-taught. He went to the library. That's why he's always espoused libraries. You know, you can hear them mentioned quite frequently. Well, I think his quote about if you want to get laid, go to college. If you want an education, go to the library.
I left high school and went to one semester of junior college in order to get laid, and met a girl, and we both dropped out, and I eventually married her. We stayed married for 5 years. I took a year and a half off and got married to Gail, and I've been married to her for about 20 years. But, you know, I wanted to get out of school as fast as possible.
Frank followed the usual teenage musician's route of joining bands, forming his own, and learning the workings of rudimentary recording studios. And for a long time, he lived hand to mouth. When eventually he got a manager, he said it lifted him from starvation level to poverty level. He was playing drums and later guitar in various clubs and involving himself in an assortment of projects when his already burgeoning subversive side was galvanized by the San Bernardino County Vice Squad. They'd been watching Frank and decided this strange-looking kid, who had befriended a white woman with a black baby, had long hair, and was trying to make a science fiction film using local people as actors, must be dealt with. An undercover cop came to an audition and offered Frank $100 to make an audio sex tape. Frank, who could use $100, recorded half an hour's worth of bogus grunts and bed springs, edited out the laughter, and when he handed it over, doors flew open, flashbulbs popped, and out came the handcuffs. It was such blatant entrapment that he could probably have got off if he kept quiet. But he treated the whole process with such derision that he served 10 days in prison. Only 10 days, but it was not a nice prison, and the experience settled any doubts he might have had about questioning authority at any opportunity. As with any knocks he took, Frank only became more resolved, more rebellious, and more creative. He persevered with the bands, finally gained a record contract, and a huge body of work ensued. In 27 years, Frank recorded over 60 albums. But as Sun Dweezil says, most people just knew him for a handful of songs.
He put out 6 records a year, some years, you know. So the idea was always to have something for people to buy so he could continue making music. And it wasn't a master plan of, I need a hit single. He never thought that way. You know, the stuff that made it to the radio was really quite by accident, and a lot of it was the humorous kind of music, whether it's Valley Girl.
Like, oh my god!
Valley Girl!
Like, totally!
Valley Girl!
And Tino's like, so bitchin'.
Valley Girl!
There's like, the Galleria.
Valley Girl!
Or, Don't Eat the Yellow Snow.
Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
Or Bobby Brown.
Hey there, people, I'm Bobby Brown. They say I'm the cutest boy in town. My car is fast, my teeth are shiny. I tell all the girls they can kiss my hiney.
The problem with those songs is that when people think of Frank, and those are the only songs they're familiar with, they tend to think of Frank as if he's Weird Al Yankovic, this guy that just makes comedy music.
They were funny, though, often painfully so, like Jewish Princess, which upset a few, although the reaction didn't bother Frank.
Well, that one did offend a lot of people, but it also made a lot of other people laugh and made a lot of other people happy, because I received letters from Jewish princesses saying, at last, there's a song about me.
I want a nasty little Jewish princess,
la, la, la,
with long bony nails and a hairdo that rinses.
Whee!
A horny little Jewish princess, with a garlic aroma that could level Tacoma.
So Frank Zappa is popularly remembered for songs like those. He's also remembered for the names he and Gail gave their children. Ahmet, Diva, Moon Unit, and Dweezil. Dweezil was the name Frank had given to an oddly shaped toe of Gale's, and they thought the name would work well for their firstborn son. The hospital, though, would have none of it, so Frank named the boy after the members of his band, Ian Donald Calvin Euclid. When Dweezil was 5, he discovered his real name on his birth certificate and demanded that they have it officially changed to Dweezil. Frank's first band was the Mothers of Invention. They were originally just called the Mothers, but the record company MGM considered that name too suggestive. Changing it was one of the few concessions Frank made to his record company. But the success of his work with the Mothers of Invention enabled Frank to finance his more ambitious musical ventures. Gale Zappa.
It turns out that, yes, rock and roll did finance the orchestral events, because he could say, all right, you know, now I'll write a check to an orchestra, which is hugely expensive, and hear what this sucker sounds like, finally. You know, on a good day, maybe, if they're not taking too many tea breaks, you know, you might get a whole piece. You might get through a whole piece.
Gale is referring to Frank's tortuous relationship with the musicians who worked for him. Steve Vai is one of the world's great rock guitarists, who's played with David Lee Roth, Whitesnake, Alice Cooper, Ozzy Osbourne, and many others, but he cut his teeth working for his hero, Frank Zappa, for whom he played on more than a dozen albums, usually credited as stunt guitarist.
He actually liked people. You know, there was this very warm, endearing quality about Frank. I mean, he was tough, and you better be ready to hear the truth when you spoke to him. But when it came to his music, you know, like all great artists, he just wanted to settle. So the habits of orchestras didn't resonate with Frank, because his music is serious, especially the stuff he writes for orchestras, and he expected it to be performed a certain way. And, you know, it was difficult, I think, in that realm for him.
Everything Frank did for money was to finance his obsession with composition. He said, if ever my kids ask me what I do, I'd say what I do is I compose. He also maintained that music comes from composers, not musicians. In 1970, the LA Philharmonic gave the first orchestral performance of a Zappa work. It was a sellout, and he was moderately pleased with it. He worked with the Ensemble Moderne, who traveled from Germany to record his music, and he thoroughly enjoyed the experience. But it didn't go so well when he tried the London Symphony Orchestra.
For those of you who might be listening who have a high regard for the London Symphony Orchestra, please let me describe the situation to you. They were paid an enormous amount of money to learn how to play and to record these pieces. A live concert of this material was given at the Barbican. Now, for those of you who have never been backstage at the Barbican, let me say this. There is a bar back there which is larger and better stocked than any bar anyplace else in the building, and it is for the use of the members of the orchestra. And between numbers, when the orchestra would take a break and go off, they would use this bar, to the extent that, when returning to the stage, many of the members of this orchestra were physically incapacitated. And one of the worst experiences of my life was listening to the second half of the concert at the Barbican, to hear a drunken orchestra trying to hoodwink the audience into believing that they were doing a craftsmanlike job on these compositions. It was actually quite shameful.
Apart from anything else, the LSO was a cooperative owned by the musicians themselves. That concept itself was anathema to Frank. Here's Gale.
Your job as a musician is to play the music. Nobody's asking you to figure out how to cure cancer or how to explain a neutron bomb. Just sit there and do the job you were trained to do.
Ideally, an orchestra is a beautiful instrument. It is one big, gorgeous instrument that can make a lot of different sounds. But only if the conductor knows what he's doing and if the musicians want to do a good job. But increasingly you find musicians who spend more time looking at their wristwatch than they do looking at the notes on the page. And when they're not looking at the notes on the page, they're heading toward that steamship in the back room.
Steve Vai was one of the few who did play the music to Frank's exacting standards. But even this guitarist, with one of the most formidable techniques, found it incredibly demanding.
Frank never played the same song the same way twice. In the 82 band, we had 80 songs under our belt, and it was the difficult stuff. Every single night was a different show. And he wrote the set list before we went on, and there was no breaks in between the songs. You had to go from one song right to another. And some of these songs, I'd have to practice every single day just to keep them under my fingers. It was a challenge, man, you know? Frank had the ability to bring you to the limit of your potential as a performer in many realms, you know, psychologically, mentally, physically. He would give you things that were right at the peak of your ability, but not anything impossible, because then you'd make mistakes. If something was unreliable under your fingers, he would take it away from you.
And on stage, just because the band had been given the set list and knew what they were playing, it didn't mean they could take anything for granted as the show went on. Dweezil again.
He designed hand signals to change the feel of a song or create tension or do anything that he wanted to within that moment. He could decide he's in the middle of a song and he could give a cue to go to a different chord, change, modulate, do something, or just create complete havoc. I mean, it could just go into atonal weirdness, and then he could create a segue into something else entirely.
He would drag his fingers down the side of his face to indicate dreadlocks, and the band would fall into a reggae rhythm. Or he would grab his crotch, which of course meant heavy metal. The hand signals were devastatingly effective and kept musicians like Steve on his toes.
You'd have to know what they were, because at any time during the show, he would give a cue and you would have to morph the music into what the cue was dictating. So he used the audience that way too. You know, he would give audiences noises to make in various sections of the audience. So then he'd create this piece of music by having everybody watch him, and he would point or give a cue, and then he'd point to the audience, and he would just, you know, wield his baton around, and next thing you know, you've got this very unique, interesting kind of a composition that involves the entire audience and the band and everything. It was nice, and it was different every night.
And that audience participation included inviting anyone to make whatever contribution he felt appropriate, as long as he could take the inevitable ribbing.
Right down to the parish of St. Alfonso. What, another poem?
I want a garden. I want a garden where the flowers have no flowers. I want a garden where the trees have no leaves. I want a garden where the weeds don't even grow. I want a garden. I want my garden. I want the garden where there are no colors. I want to water that garden. I'll garden that with my tears, whilst that garden, whilst the trees, whilst the leaves, water me with my own.
Oh, you want kindergarten.
Frank loved his audience, and he loved to entertain. But it was an audience member who was to slow him down. It happened when Frank came over to tour in Europe in 1971.
That tour was doomed. So the first thing that happened is they lost all their equipment in the fire in Montreux, and that's documented by Deep Purple. Thank you very much, lads.
The fire at the concert in Montreux was devastating, as Frank was so dependent on the huge amount of equipment they carried. When the blaze broke out, though, Frank dealt with it from the stage as though it were a minor irritation.
calmly go towards the exit, ladies and gentlemen.
And as Gail said, that night inspired the writing of one of the most iconic of hard rock songs. Deep Purple had been in the audience and wrote Smoke on the Water in tribute to that strange night. But the fire was just the beginning of Frank's problems.
They moved on quickly to London and rented all this equipment. And I wasn't there for that event, but apparently this guy got past the lack of security onto the stage and pushed Frank into the orchestra pit.
It's never been established whether the fan thought Frank was making eyes at his girlfriend or whether he'd taken exception to something in the performance. After a fall of 15 feet onto concrete, the band thought Frank was dead. His neck appeared to be broken. He had head wounds, a broken rib, and a fractured leg. He spent the better part of a year in a wheelchair, and as a result of the neck injury, when he recovered his voice, his vocal range was lowered considerably. He said later that having a lower voice was nice, but he would have preferred some other means of acquiring it. The music press made a big deal of Frank's accident. In fact, they wrote a lot about Frank over the years, invariably about what they perceived as his weirdness and his antics. Precious little, almost nothing, about his serious music. Not that he did much to endear himself to the journalists, or indeed the musicians. He famously described rock journalism as people who can't write, doing interviews with people who can't think, in order to prepare articles for people who can't read. He was similarly scathing about new music critics when he decried them as tone-deaf elitists who use the premiere performance of every new work as an opportunity to sharpen their word skills. New music exponents today, though, look at Frank's work with great respect and admiration. This is David Butcher, chief executive of the Britten Sinfonia.
The biggest compliment I can pay is to think of a composer like Stravinsky, who wrote in many, many different styles. You had the Rite of Spring Stravinsky, you had the neoclassical Stravinsky, you had the late 12-tone Stravinsky, and you could almost mirror that in terms of Frank's serious output. But I would say, like Stravinsky, whether it's very jazz-based or rock-based, or whether it's dissonant and Varese-like, you know, it's Frank Zappa.
Another composer who would form a close relationship with Frank was Pierre Boulez, who recorded Frank's work.
Perfect Strange, of course, was recorded by Boulez, and Boulez was an early fan, which is, as one of, I think, the great composers, but also one of the great conductors, is a huge tribute. It's a fantastic album, and a huge tribute to Frank Zappa that someone like Boulez would champion his music. And also interpret it so well. He really got it. That's the one thing people say about that disc, is that he really got to the heart of that music.
Frank Zappa died of cancer in 1993, aged 52. Towards the end of his life, he increasingly espoused causes that were getting under his skin. He railed against the Parents Music Resource Center, a group of Washington senators' wives who wanted to put warning labels on albums whose lyrics they considered to be unsuitable for young people. And he had a particular dislike for televangelists, whom he considered loathsome and corrupt.
If God really is all-powerful, and if he's all-knowing, and if he's really God, he doesn't need any help from a jerk in a silk suit who's asking you for money. So if you want God, go direct. Don't use the TV, go direct.
There's a ugly little weasel, about 3'9", face puffed up from crying and laughing.
Those are sweet little hubbies, and they cause strong part time. In the name of the Lord.
Get a clue, little shrew, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Jesus thinks you're a jerk. Would he really choose Tabby to do his work?
Jesus thinks you're a jerk. By the 80s, Frank Zappa was gaining a following from many who may have been less aware of his music, but who had great admiration for his political and social activism. Peter Occhiogrosso.
I'm writing a book about Frank. Some of it grew out of my experiences of working with him, but also an appreciation of his role in the political environment of the time that I feel is very much appropriate now. I mean, he was very much a First Amendment spokesman, somebody who believed in freedom of speech, freedom of the press. He was not somebody who suffered fools gladly. He was very critical not only of government, but also of all the people that he saw as essentially scamming America. I can't help thinking how great it would be to have someone like Frank Zappa active now, someone who is a popular entertainer, but who also could be very outspoken about these issues.
Frank died when he was reaching the summit of his powers. In normal circumstances, he would have gone on to release his music to the world and do it in the way in which he wanted it done. As it happens, it remains locked up in his archive. It's being released in dribs and drabs, with orchestras desperate to realize it and give it form. I won't ever forget Frank, who established a standard for me about what it is to be a social critic and what it is to be honest in your public life. We asked those whom we interviewed for their favorite Frank Zappa composition. And understandably, with such a massive body of work, they were hard-pressed to do so. I know mine, though. And this is what they'll be playing at Germaine Greer's funeral.
G-Spot Tornado, played by the Britten Sinfonia and conducted by Stefan Asbury. Freak Out, the Frank Zappa story, was presented by Germaine Greer, produced by Nick Barraclough, and was a Smooth Operations production for BBC Radio 4.